few more thoughts on clarifying meditation practice. This is the practical part. I'm conscious that our retreat is coming to a close soon, and I am conscious we have not come to the end of the Satipatthana teaching, so there is a slight discrepancy between what I feel is there and what I feel we can pack in realistically. So before I give you a kind of overview, a quick overview, I'd like to tell you a very brief anecdote of a great Chinese master. Some of you may know that in Buddhist, particularly in later Buddhism, early Indian Buddhism, there are two big strands. You know, one Buddhist school, those are great meditators. They had an approach that the thing that really moves is consciousness. You know, the thing that is really the most real in all things is mind. Those were the Yogacarins, Chittamatrins. They were very influential for Zen Buddhism. And then the other big school, that was parallel, and they loved to quarrel with each other. You know, some of the greatest thinking in India comes from these two big schools debating with each other. The nice thing about Buddhist schools debating is they don't kill each other. They prefer to actually debate. Yeah, sometimes they lived in the same monasteries, and their debate practice has brought some of the greatest clarity and depth to Buddhist teaching. The emptiness school, they were also meditators. They felt that not mind was the most real thing, but that they insisted that the emptiness aspect of experience, of knowledge, of world, this is the most profound thing. So the emptiness people and the mind-only people, they were sometimes not in agreement with each other. And there's this great Chinese master called Matsu, and he was part of the mind-only school. So he said, the mind is the Buddha, the mind is the Buddha, the mind is the Buddha. That was his big teaching. And his disciples complained and said, well, you're only teaching this one thing. It's getting a bit boring over time. So he said, well, when my disciples stop weeping and crying, I'm going to give them the real teaching. So he said, we have long stopped weeping and crying. We're not weeping and crying. Give us the real teaching. He said, okay, you've asked for it. No mind, no Buddha. So you have all kind of grown beyond the first stages of practice and grown beyond the first days of practice. So I would like to give you a brief glance at what I understand the necessary minimal prerequisites for any meditation practice to be liberating in the sense of the Buddha's teaching. I'm not going to use Pali terms for this because I have given you some Pali terms. You have the four Satipatthana as a very simple, as a very direct teaching of the Buddha, where he says on what foundations we should establish awareness. I'd like to speak in a psychological language quickly and give you a sort of an idea of what stages we need in meditation. This is my current understanding, so please be careful. Everything that comes from me, you have to carefully measure with your own experience and take it from where it comes, namely, this is an unfinished project, yeah, Akin Shino, and his liberation is an unfinished project. So you have to be somewhat careful when you take this on board. Yeah? You have to measure and use your own intelligence. But there are four stages of meditation practice, which I think if any of those stages is missing, something goes wrong. I would call the first stage of meditation practice the stilling of mind. Indispensable. If we think, if we try to approach what is difficult, either psychologically difficult or existentially difficult, or what is truly spiritually challenging, if we try to figure that out by cognitive thinking, discursive process, that means your critical mind, your scientifically trained intellect, and so forth, all this, it's not going to work out. Yeah. There is no transformative and liberating truth to be found simply by clever or intelligent or systematic reasoning. That's very clear in the Buddhist teaching. So the capacity of the mind to wake up comes from a deeper layer of the mind. And to attain this deeper layer, we need to be able to get the mind from a distracted, fragmented state into a state of relative stillness. In fact, as much as you can get of it. Now, we need to, in this stage, we need to have strategies, techniques, method to make the mind still, to come to a place of rest in the heart, to be okay with things as they are. Yeah. So any meditation that is going to have a transformative or a curative effect in your life will need the capacity to disengage, disentangle the awareness from its fixations, from its obsessions, from its distractions, and come back to a chosen place of rest, preferably something that allows stillness. Yeah. If you have a choice, go to the breath. This is the probably most universal vehicle. There is even a breath meditation in Christian tradition. Did you know there's some great Orthodox Hesychiast teachers who have known the heart and breath meditation? So this is not just Buddhists alone. You know, there's a profound insight in the validity of breath as a vehicle between body and mind. That stage of stilling, disengaging the mind from its habitual preoccupation is a crucial one. The next stage, let's call it gaining perspective. The next stage is about distance. It's about stepping back. Now, if you wanted to be polemic, you could say this is a dissociative state. You want to dissociate the mind, to disidentify the mind from its attachments to specific experience. You want to say, okay, this is anger, not my anger, but there is anger. Yeah. And by saying so, you acknowledge there is also something else than anger, if you're angry. Yeah? That part of you which knows that you're angry is not angry. So this little dissociative technique is very, very crucial to gain perspective. It's the literal word retreat, yeah? To pull it back, pulling back, distancing yourself. This is crucial. So it is particularly crucial with powerfully emotional states, states that threaten to flood us. We can choose to go away from that which is difficult. Before we cannot choose to go away, and in fact stay away from something difficult, we have very bad tools to actually negotiate that difficulty. If we can't stay away from it, it's very likely that we're going to be sucked in. So the first skill, after we've established some stillness, is trying to establish a distance to the topic, to the challenge, to the thing we are going to investigate. Many people think that second stage is meditation. Doing something that allows me to go someplace where I am safe, where it doesn't hurt anymore, where I can stay in control. That is understandable, but that is obviously not meditation. It is an indispensable requisite, but it's only part of it. If we make this second stage meditation then we will just learn to control difficult things in our life by going away. As you know, this doesn't change the difficult things, because we can't stay out there. Yeah, we have to come back, and then the difficulties are still there. And we haven't learned anything. So this second stage is necessary for us to allow perspective, to allow the big picture to come in. So that we can say, okay, there is a problem, but we are not just that problem. I am not the problem. I can be with that problem. I can be in awareness of that problem. Yeah, that is very different than being the problem. So that second stage is very crucial. The third stage is pretty much the opposite of the second stage. The third stage is where insight truly happens. It's once we know that we can stay away from the problem, from that which is difficult, from that which is besotting or fascinating or repulsive or shocking or overwhelming, once we know we can stay out of this, we very, very carefully go back in and look at it more clearly, more closely, with the help of our stillness, with the help of our mobile awareness, with the help of our discernment, we go back in and look at it. Is it permanent? Is it mine? Is it truly pleasurable? Or am I mistaken there? Can I investigate this? What are its causes? What are its supporting conditions? Is it doing what I expect it to do? Do I have other options of being with this? Yeah. This is the insight moment. So we go very respectfully, very carefully, we go back in, yeah, from the place where we have dissociated in the step before. Unless we are willing to do that, and unless we are realistic in doing that, I have to say, meditation is not going to produce insight. We're just going to become a little more still, we don't understand much, and when the conditions for stillness go away, we get agitated again. So we go to the next retreat, we get a little more still, and we go out of retreat, and our life continues as normal. So this is using meditation like using a pill, yeah? You just use a painkiller. It doesn't necessarily cure. It makes you feel better for a while, and then if the effect stops, the reason for the pain may have not gone away. Now it still is a valid and it still is a legitimate practice, but there is much more to meditation practice than just controlling your agitated life and establishing a few tricks to cope better. There is a lot more power in Buddhist meditation than this controlling aspect. So the third stage, because we have learned to stay away from something, we know we can trust ourselves that we can create perspective, create distance, create a vision for the big picture. We allow ourselves to go in and look, what does actually stop us from being happy? What does stop us from being free? What does stop us from acting effectively? Now, this stage is crucial. This is where purification happens. This is where you meet hindrances. This is where the mind gets truly concentrated, not by will, but by its own inclination to seek the happiness of unification. Once you have done some of that, the fourth stage is the big picture again. It's like you go out again and you start establishing patterns. You start understanding causality. You start understanding dependent origination. You start understanding patterns of how the mind works, you know. You look at the Satipatthana teachings, you always have the sequence of Ajata, he looks at this in himself, and Bahinda, he looks at this in others. Yeah? So looking at this in others doesn't mean I'm going to watch her breath or his movements, but I look, how does anger work in this heart? How does anger work in that heart? If I know it here, I will know it there. If I know how to handle it here, I will be able to be more competent in handling anger out there. If you can't handle angry people, it probably means you can't handle your own anger. Yeah? if you can't handle indecisive people or anxious people, it probably means you have some issues with this in your own lives. So stage four gives us a picture which is not personal anymore. It understands the principles by which happiness and harmony and wisdom operates in impersonal ways. Not just as cognitive knowledge, as learning, but it is a knowledge that is based on empirical experience, your experience as a meditator, your contemplative competence is brought together with the big understanding of Dharmic principles, particularly the principle of dependent origination, how suffering comes to arise, how suffering comes to cease, the value of ethics in life, ethical causality, as is a translation for karma, and the patterns, how human beings defend from reality, the patterns that help human beings to grow, how learning works, this kind of thing. Yeah? So this is part of the fourth stage. Now, obviously this is a big project, and it is ambitious to pack something of that in a small week, but be conscious, even if we practice only a segment of the big program, consider in any segment you have things that come first. And while I'm speaking, I'm not sure whether it works, but I'm trying to speak neatly and clearly about these stages or about these satipatthanas. You see, they happen concurrently. While I can say, okay, this is first, and then that, and then that, and this is called like this, the truth is they're all happening all the time, yeah? The complexity of experience is such that we can only take these things apart in our head, nominally. The four satipatthanas are not really happening one after the other. Yeah? We can choose under which angle we look at them. But they're happening all the time. I said it before, it's like the TV. The frequencies are there. If we switch the channel, we find that all the channels are there. Our awareness chooses to focus on a particular aspect because at a particular stage of our practice, this is necessary. It is necessary to have some discipline and stillness before you try to take on the big questions of your life. But the big questions of your life sometimes don't wait till you have decided it's time for them. Sometimes they come, yeah? They talk to you. So you need to be realistic. When the mind has some stillness, it is useful to open the mind and look at what is there. What are the topics in my life? What is important? What do I need to address? What are the questions? What is the burning? Where is the pain in this life? Can I bring the clarity, the amount of clarity I have, however imperfect it may seem, can I bring that clarity there? And then you try to hold the space rather than engage the problem, delve in it, think about it, and become part of it, and become part of the problem. You try to keep the perspective wide open. You keep the peripheral vision going while you are with the problem. You go closer and you try not to become part of the problem. You try not to merge and see what is really happening there. Is this really what it seems like? What does it foot on? What does it find its ground in? And sometimes that works and you will have insights. If you can sustain an awareness and with the strengths of your stillness of mind or the strength of your clarity, you can understand. By being with difficult things, you will understand what's happening there. Sometimes it doesn't work. We get sucked in or we get repelled. Then you go to the breath. You go back to a practice of stilling the mind. I call this shuttling. Yeah, you're a commuter between stillness and insight. So if you find that you can hold your awareness, that the mind can stay open to the process of what's happening, fine. If you start thinking about it, if you start getting infected by what you have tried to understand more profoundly in a discursive or in a cognitive way, you have to give up. You have to say, well, it doesn't work. My stillness isn't strong enough. My sati isn't strong enough. So back to the breath, back to the posture. I need more muscle, yeah? The candle is not thick enough. If you think of the image from last night for samadhi. So you may have to do that several times in a session. When you go home, you spend half of the time of your meditation in trying to gain stillness. There may be times in your meditation when you're so tired that the only practice is staying awake. Then the practice is staying awake. So stop fantasizing about jhanas or so. The practice now is staying awake, full stop. This is good practice. You can learn a lot by that. Okay, it's not jhanas, but you learn patience, you learn honesty, you learn body awareness, you learn consistency. There's a lot of virtue in just staying awake if you're tired. And that's the realistic thing to do. So this is what is asked for, rather than wonder whether, yeah, neither perception nor non-perception really feels that way, or how it would feel like if you had it or so. So be clear, be honest, be straight. And one of the things in practice we need to is orientation. Our system isn't always capable of doing what we think it should do or what we think we would like to do. So orienting towards the resources we have. How mindful is this? How much mindfulness is in the system? Do I need to have a big meditation object because I'm not very mindful and need to get anything I can place my mind on? Or is my mindfulness quite alive, quite good, quite mobile? Can I take something small? Yeah? Can I refine it? So we need to be able to understand, not to judge, but to understand what we need. Our needs differ. And then you need to identify areas which are difficult. I found out after some years of practice, I'm happy to admit, that suddenly I didn't feel anything for about a stretch of 10 centimeters across my chest. And I realized that because I couldn't listen to the word heart. I felt the word heart always was kitsch. Whenever somebody used the word heart, I felt that they were trying to cheat me. I'm trying not to be clear, you know, being kind of sort of emotionally gooey, or they were trying to sell me something. They were kind of smarmy, romantic. And I noticed I had this kind of aversion every time this word heart came up. You know, Buddhism is full of heart, you know, and compassion and the mind and the heart and, you know, the lotus in the heart and it's full of this heart stuff. And I didn't really want this, you know. I said, just be clear, you know, give me the scoop, give me the clarity, don't give me this heart business. And then I noticed I didn't feel anything here. You know, my sensations are quite accurate and they continue quite accurate, but there is this gap. And incidentally, this happens to be at the level of heart, yeah? So I realized there's something is foul there, something's fishy there. So I began to just try to breathe into my heart for many months. Many months, every day, whatever they taught me, I didn't listen. I just was breathing into my heart. You know, like digging with a teaspoon, that's how it felt initially. Digging with a teaspoon in my breastbone, kind of digging in. Just kind of scratching and digging and digging and breathing and scratching and digging and breathing. And suddenly this kind of came back and I started to feel all kinds of things. First of all, really pain. Not big love stories, but just pain. Honest, straight, wretched back pain. Yeah, at the level of my heart. And then this seemed to widen, and I started to actually be able to stay there in my meditation. In my body scans, I didn't have this jump from somewhere above my chest to somewhere in my belly. There was actually a part in between that I recognized, oh God, yeah, there is something there. And suddenly I could listen to the word heart. The aversion against the term heart had dropped away. So I'll tell you this not because, I tell you this because sometimes things happen to you that nobody talks of and nobody seems to speak of. So that's why you have to be more clever than the people whom you come and listen to, you see? Because they never quite know what you really need. So it's you who have to choose to whom you listen, and it's you who have to choose where to attend. You are your expert. So if there are things happening in your meditation experience that you stumble again and again with, find ways to investigate them. Carefully, respectfully, curiously, and find help, find your own help. Use your intelligence, use every trick in the book. It's perfectly legitimate. Yeah. Learn to inquire into that which blocks you, which stops you, where you feel your power come back to you. Learn to inquire into this. We need to track energy. We need to track vitality. Weak people are not good people. There is no virtue in being weak. Yeah. We cannot afford being weak because we are afraid of our emotions or because we are afraid of our aggressions. We need to find where the vitality grows for us. We need to find what stops the vitality. So if you meet things in your practice, inquire. Find out what's happening there. If it's difficult, try to find help. There are many, you know, we all have different stories. We all are here for good reasons. And some of the things I may not talk about, yeah? Or you may not have, if you open Buddhist books, they may not speak in the way you experience this. So you need to make the translation. You will need to use your intelligence to bring together what's happening for you and what meditation teaching offers. So with the encouragement to do shuttle practice, I would like to leave you for today. You have various tools to still the mind, breath, posture, mindfulness of movement. I have said that it is a very useful tool to investigate the quality that distracts you, whether it is pleasant things, unpleasant things, mental things or bodily things. And it is a useful exercise to try to separate the impact sensory experience from outside, or a thought or a memory from the inside have, and your reaction to this experience. Now the truth is there are several reactions. Yeah? The first reaction may be, don't like it, unpleasant. The second reaction may be sadness. Yeah? So you have a sensory impingement, a thought coming up. I'm thinking of Petra or, you know, Xaver or somebody, and something happens. I don't like thinking of him. And okay, I notice this is Peter popping up, and then I don't like thinking of Peter, and then my heart sinks. You know, I'm feeling guilty, or I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling sad. So we have three stages. The impact, the impingement, which we would call a distraction when we do mindfulness of breath. Then you have the Vedana, which is unpleasant. And then you have a Citta, which is a mind state, a mood coming in. So see whether it is possible to slow down as much that you can distinguish these stages of experience. The immediate liking, not liking response, which I call feeling tone, and the mood that may come with this. If we think long enough of Peter, something happens. If I love Peter and I look forward to Peter, my heart will widen and there's a warmth and it will be easy. If I have difficulties with Peter, those difficulties will color my emotion. Yeah, I will feel frustrated or bitter or unhappy or sad or grieving. So try to view the stages. We cannot stop that so quickly, but you can view the stages. The thought, the liking, not liking, and the emotion that follows that. You also notice that where the liking and not liking operates, we have a quick distribution of awareness. The awareness goes to the things we like, generally, and goes away from the things we dislike. Not always. Yeah, sometimes people are fascinatingly ugly or something really, something so, you know, strongly unpleasant that we're quite curious how this can be. Yeah, yeah. Somebody has a really shrill laugh, or you know, we kind of look. I mean, how can she not notice what she's doing? Yeah. So it's not just the pleasant thing that attracts us, but mostly we definitely favor comfort, pleasant experience, gratification, and so forth. Yeah. And we go away from the other things. See whether you can notice that impulse of shifting away and shifting toward. The idea in our practice is that we stabilize awareness, that it doesn't move away when it's unpleasant, and it doesn't kind of follow after if it's pleasant. Yeah? We're looking for something that is anchored. Anchored with what is real, not with what is pleasant. If you're in the meditation and you feel a reasonable degree of stillness, open up and look what's coming. That's the moment to be choiceless about. Look what is coming. What is bubbling up? What is on the surface? What stops me from getting more still? Can I be with this? Don't try to attack it or, you know, penetrate it with, you know, a Manjushri sword or something like that. Try to be with it and let it talk. Wait till it speaks to you. Wait till it undoes itself. If it sucks you in, acknowledge you have been sucked in. Go back to the breath. So, please let us practice. We have another day. Thank you.